Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. Is it possible to conceive of the American diet without bagels, or Star Trek without Mr. Spock? Are the creatures in Maurice Sendak's We're the Wild Things Are based on Holocaust survivors? And how has Yiddish, a language without a country, influenced Hollywood? These and other questions are explored in the stunning and rich anthology of the interplay of Yiddish and American culture entitled How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish, published by Restless Books in 2020 and edited by Ilan Stavins and Josh Lambert. Josh Lambert is the Sophia Moses Robeson Associate Professor of Jewish Studies at English and Director of the Jewish Studies Program at Wesley College. From 2011 to 2020, he was the Academic Director of the Yiddish Book Center. Josh, I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
So to get started, please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to this work.
Sure. So this is an interesting book because it's an anthology. It's not a monograph or a project, a sort of typical scholarly project. It came out of the work that I did at the Yiddish Book Center for almost a decade. Before that, I got a PhD. My PhD is in English literature with a focus on Jewish studies. After my PhD at the University of Michigan, I went to do a postdoc at NYU for a couple of years. And then I was offered this job at the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts, which I wasn't that familiar with as an institution, but I became very familiar over a decade of working there. This book, How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish, really came up towards the end of my time working at the Book Center when we were approaching the Yiddish Book Center's 40th anniversary as an institution, and we were looking at different ways of celebrating that anniversary. Now, it happened that that anniversary was in 2020, which was quite a year. So many of the different kinds of celebrations that we had planned or were working on couldn't happen. Some of them were, in-person events. But thankfully, this book was able to come to fruition and get out there in the world and really reach a lot of people. It was really exciting to see a lot of people respond to this book. That was sort of how the process began. And I can tell you a little bit more about how it came together. But really, it's... as much as it was a lot of fun to put it together as an editor with Ilan Stavans and myself, really it's a testament to or a monument of the Book Center itself as an institution.
I hear you. So to set the stage for our listeners, tell us a little bit about Yiddish. How old is Yiddish?
Okay. I'll
start off with easy ones.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, just one of those topics that scholars love to argue about and no one has a straight answer for it. No, no, for people who don't know, Yiddish is a language. It's just important to say that. It's one of the most important and most widely spoken Jewish languages. There are a few other Jewish languages that people have probably heard of, like Hebrew and maybe Ladino or Judeo-Arabic. Yiddish was a language that we, you know, in a general sense, think is about 1,000-ish years old. There's some debate among linguists who are much more knowledgeable than I am in philology about exactly where, in what precise place it started, but somewhere in Central Europe. It moved with Jewish populations into Eastern Europe. It is a language that has a lot of elements shared with German. It picked up a lot of Slavic elements. It has always had a lot of Semitic elements shared with Hebrew, or what in Yiddish is called Loshon Kodesh, which is, you know, the sort of Hebraic component of Yiddish. And it was spoken by the vast majority of Jews on the planet for many centuries. We have Yiddish texts going back many, many centuries, and Yiddish books going back to soon after the invention of printing. It's a language that became very, very important to European Jewish communities, and then the vast diaspora Jewish community in the 19th century, as it became entwined with different political movements and ideologies and different sort of possibilities for modern Jews. And it's a language that's still spoken as the sort of mother tongue, as the home language of hundreds of thousands of people around the world. People sometimes feel like talk about Yiddish as a language that suffered a great loss, as it did in the 20th century, as many Yiddish speakers were murdered in the Holocaust. But it's a language that continues to be spoken and written in and used for all sorts of things.
Right. So speaking of the Holocaust, before the Holocaust, just to give a sense of the breadth of the reach of Yiddish as a language, where were Yiddish speakers living? I mean, how far, spread out were Yiddish speakers around the world pre-World War II?
Yeah, very much almost anywhere in the that you can think of Jews having reached in the diaspora, there were Yiddish speakers. And that's kind of mind-boggling and strange to think about. I was, once a student asked me, was there any Yiddish in Egypt? And you come to find that there were Yiddish publications coming out in Egypt in the early part of the 20th century, not huge numbers, but because the Ashkenazi Ashkenaz is the Yiddish word for basically the area we think of as Eastern Europe or Central to Eastern Europe, because of the diaspora of Jews from those lands really spread all over the world, you had many millions of Yiddish speakers in Europe. You had millions of Yiddish speakers in North America. You had some Yiddish speakers, significant numbers in South America. You had Yiddish speakers, a whole Lithuanian community in South Africa. You certainly had Yiddish speakers in Australia. There are very few places where you couldn't have found someone to speak Yiddish to you. And there's lots of stories that people like to tell about that. There was a sense in which much more so, especially in the early part of the 20th century, before the sort of full revival of Hebrew as a vernacular, Yiddish was a language that tied Jews together almost throughout the world. Obviously, there were lots of Jews who didn't speak Yiddish, but still, in most places, you could find some Yiddish speakers.
Right. And was Yiddish always seen as a respected, legitimate language?
No. it was not. No, it's a thank you for asking that. And it's, you know, it's a complicated topic. And not so much covered as much depth as you'd like in the anthology that we did. But it has a complicated history, as a lot of vernaculars have, as a lot of Jewish languages have. Yiddish played a particular role in people's lives at different times. So, you know, I think it's very famous, but I guess if you're in Yiddish circles, it's kind of famous that we have books from the 17th century, from the 18th century, that would say, that would be a Yiddish book, and they would be sort of apologetic about being written in Yiddish. And they might say something like, this book is written in Yiddish for women and for men who are not so educated, so that they need a book in Yiddish. Because the sort of idea of that was that well-educated Jewish men would be able to read in Hebrew, but women and less educated Jewish men would end up reading in Yiddish. Now, whether that was actually true, whether that was accurate to the situation, you know, you can ask a lot of questions about, but there was a sort of persistent sense of, you can say, a dismissive attitude toward Yiddish by all sorts of different people who felt like it wasn't as much as respectable a language as important a language as Hebrew, or as, let's say, German or other major non-Jewish languages. So there was a lot of disagreement about the value of the language, at the same time as it was the vernacular in which people fell in love and raised their children and did their business. So it was the sort of life of you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people for many centuries, and sort of inestimable value in that sense, right? You can't deny its value when it was spoken and used by so many people to live their lives.
Sure, but it seems that these days, the kind of status of Yiddish has changed profoundly in terms of how well it's regarded, how much it's respected, maybe even for some people revered. What do you think has contributed to this change in its status?
That's absolutely the case. I completely agree with that. That there's, you know, there will always be people, and I, you know, at Jewish studies conferences, there will always be people complaining about Yiddish not getting as much attention as it deserves. And of course, in many ways, it doesn't. At the same time, it is a really incredible thing, right, that in Jewish studies, in the academy, there are plenty of places to go study Yiddish, plenty of people working with Yiddish in their research, lots and lots of respect for it. And I find, I'm curious if you find this with your students, but among students that I meet, college students, there's a lot of excitement about Yiddish. There's a lot of interest and fascination with it. And you see that in popular culture, too. There's a lot of... just even in the last few years, there's a lot of pop culture examples of Hollywood movies or things like that where Yiddish is used, and it comes from some sort of fascination with Yiddish. And where does that come from? Where does that fascination come from? It's a complicated thing. Part of it is certainly has to do with nostalgia and with people's Ashkenazi Jews' feelings about their grandparents, their great-grandparents, the languages they spoke. I think also there is a part of it we have to acknowledge is that there's a greater interest in new or different forms of Jewish connectedness, and that Yiddish often helps people imagine that. So in other words, you know, whereas in America in the 1960s, a lot of Jewish community organization happened around synagogues and around Jewish community centers, and sort of centralizing institutions in American Jewish life. Now there are a lot of people who are thinking back to older, you know, to early 20th century political models for Jewish community, or looking sort of ahead in a futuristic way, using Yiddish to imagine different kinds of futures. So I think, you know, that's part of what's going on. But the final thing I have to say on you know, explaining or trying to gesture at like how Yiddish gets to where it is really to talk about the Yiddish Book Center, which is part of a whole movement of people who really cared a lot about Yiddish and worked really hard to create opportunities for people to engage with it. You know, it's having its 40th anniversary this year because 40 years ago, a guy who is still the president of the Yiddish Book Center and was for many years my boss and a delightful person, Aaron Lansky, you know, had been a graduate student who wanted to study Yiddish novels. And he didn't know where to find them because academic libraries didn't stock Yiddish novels and bookstores didn't have them. And so he realized that the only good place to find a Yiddish novel was a good Jewish cafeteria or deli where you could go and say, hey, does anybody have a copy of Tevye der Melchiker? Like, you know, the Tevye stories by Shalom Aleichem, a very famous set of Yiddish stories. And someone would say, oh, sure, young man, here, come to my apartment. I'll give you a copy of this book. Aaron spent, you know, and with many, many people helping him and sort of working with him, spent the next several decades collecting hundreds of thousands, millions of Yiddish books, bringing them together, sorting them, reorganizing them, and then sending them out to libraries so that now if you go to most academic libraries, there'll be a few thousand Yiddish books, and those books mostly pass through the Yiddish Book Center. And anyone you know who works with Yiddish, anybody, anywhere in the world, knows the Yiddish Book Center because of the online book collection, because almost a decade ago now, the Yiddish Book Center digitized more than 10,000 Yiddish books, which is a large percentage of all the Yiddish books ever published. And they're really, it's not like Google Books where you go on and you can do snippet view and you can see like three words. You can see every page of every one of those, I don't know, 11,000, 12,000 Yiddish books. And so when you're doing research, it absolutely transformed the field. And I think that, you know, that sort of effort on the part of the Book Center, along with what I worked on there, were educational programs trying to, you know, teach people Yiddish, but also just help them to see the value of, you know, where Yiddish might contribute to the things that they're thinking about, how it's related to or relevant to the stuff that they care about. I hope has played a role in making, in bringing seriousness and not just a sort of sense of kitsch or nostalgia to the way that we think about Yiddish, but also really honoring the fact that Yiddish plays a huge role in the, you know, and has played a huge role in the sort of world we live in the world we occupy, and that it's worth thinking about and spending time on.
Sure. Speaking of Yiddish as a language, what are some of the stereotypes of Yiddish as a language?
All the stereotypes that you would love, all the great ones. Jeffrey Chandler, who I keep thinking of in this conversation, because he's a great scholar who has a new book called Yiddish, a Biography, which I really recommend also. Has written about Yiddish in really interesting ways. He cites some scholars who talked about the ways in which when a language becomes used less, it often tends to maintain the sort of most emotionally intense parts of language usage. And so Yiddish, part of the stereotypes we have about Yiddish, if you talk to an American about Yiddish, they'll often know curse words, right? They'll know taboo words and dirty words. They'll know sweet words and nostalgic words. You know, they'll know bubi zeda, you know, the words for grandparents. But then they'll also know the words for unmentionable things. And it makes sense in a way, because those are the sort of emotional extremes of a language. They're not the sort of day-to-day quotidian, you know, simple things, you know, can I have a sandwich? It's more the curses, the blessings, the intense parts of it. So, right. So people, you know, stereotype Yiddish as jargon, you know, as a gutter language, as filthy in a sexual sense. They'll stereotype it as, you know, not a real language. I'm trying to think. I'm sure I'm missing some.
Well, I'm curious. I think that you mentioned in the book that there supposedly there's no word for sex appeal or for weapons in Yiddish. That this is a stereotype of Yiddish. That there's something very pure I don't know, safe or something, that it didn't encompass these kinds of words.
Yeah, those are, that's amazing. Those are the stereotypes that Yiddish speakers portray of their language. So right, it's the great Yiddish writer who, you know, is one of the most important Yiddish writers, Yud Lamed Peretz, who says in his classic poem from the 1880s that there's no word for love in Yiddish, which is absolutely not true. It's just, you know, it's, I guess in a poem you can say whatever you want, but, you know, there's no truth to that. And then Isaac Bashevis Singer, who is the only Yiddish writer to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech says that there are no Yiddish words for weapons, which is just not, I mean, also, it's not true. There, you know, it's a language like any other, and people had to sometimes talk about weapons. But those are ideas at different points that have salience for people, right? Bashevis, speaking in, you know, in the post-war period, wanted to project an image of Yiddish as, you know, disconnected from, you know, nation states and their violence, a sort of diaspora Yiddish land language that isn't responsible for the kinds of things that German and French and English are responsible for. And Peretz, writing in the 1880s, was doing something that a lot of writers do, which is, you know, trying to think about the limitations of a particular reading audience or the way that a language has been stereotyped, but trying to sort of break away from that, I think. So, right. I mean, like any other language we could talk about, right. People say all sorts of very strange things about it. And I think the part, what's sometimes very, very hard for people, especially people who are native speakers of Yiddish, who really care about it, who really feel like it's central to their identity, is that it can feel very silly or even offensive to them when their language is talked about like, it's only funny, right? Like that every Yiddish word is somehow funny, or that it's all silly or dirty or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I've had...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
A similar kind of reaction when it comes to klezmer, to Yiddish music. And I feel that as someone who grew up in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community and spoke Yiddish from when I was a child, in school, I always find it strange that a lot of the klezmer music that seems to be played is kind of very sappy, very sort of like happy, upbeat melodies. And my favorite Yiddish song is Kofshe Papirosin, about this little boy who's starving to death and trying to sell a few cigarettes to survive the frigid nights. And, you know, it's a very, very sad and you know, really disturbing song, but it's like the antithesis of what seems to me is commonly understood as being, you know, what is klezmer or Jewish or Yiddish music. It's this very kind of cheery, upbeat tunes. And like you said, it feels to me like that assumption kind of robs the language and its music of so much of its humanity.
Yeah, what I end up so often saying about Yiddish is that it's a language. You can do anything. You can say anything in Yiddish. You can say sappy, romantic things. You can say very cynical, bitter things. You can say political things. You can say anything. And I really, no disrespect to the linguists who sort of are revising Sapir-Whorf and, you know, figuring out the ways in which language might be related to culture. But I think the bottom line is a language is a tool of the people who speak it. And when you have millions and millions of people speaking a language, it's not sensible to say that it is one thing or can only be one way. It really is as flexible as the lives and imaginations of the people who speak it.
Absolutely. To shift gears a bit and talk about your anthology. So how is your anthology organized? How did you figure out what to make sense of the tremendous potential mass of materials that are out there, to, you know, what to incorporate and how to incorporate it into the anthology?
Thanks for asking about it. It was a fun project to do. When we had to put together this anthology very quickly, and also in honor of the Yiddish Book Center, the one of the first things we realized is that rather than starting from scratch and saying we're going to take all the Yiddish materials in the world and think about what deserves to be in an anthology, we started with the Yiddish Book Center's magazine called Pachenträger, which has been published for 40 years through the whole history of the Yiddish Book Center, and is a English language magazine that publishes translations from Yiddish literature and stories about Yiddish activists and people doing things in Yiddish. And it was just, and it is a magazine that, with its own irony, is not that available. A lot of libraries don't have collections of it. So it's actually, if you're not a member of the Yiddish Book Center, you probably haven't seen a lot of the material from that magazine before. So we started with, we got 40 years of the magazine in front of us, quite literally, back when you could be in a room. and we flipped through a lot of it to think what would be a good sort of framework for the anthology and what would start. And what we decided was not to go chronologically to really try. We decided we couldn't aim for any kind of comprehensiveness because then it would be, 3,000 pages long, but to pick material that sort of reflected some of what we've been talking about, right? Some of the ideas people have about Yiddish, some of the energy and excitement in it, and really some of the things that I've found over the years draw students to it, right? Like, why does a student show up in a Yiddish class, who's never studied Yiddish before, and what's making them interested in that? So, we ended up creating sections that talk about different aspects of what Yiddish opens up in our thinking. So one, the first section is called Politics and Possibility. And it's about, to some degree, what happened when Jewish immigrants arrived in America and had a new set of opportunities. And it's to some degree about modernization and just the new opportunities of the 20th century and how that was experienced through the viewpoints of Yiddish speakers and Yiddish artists. So, we have in that example, short fiction by Ibn Khan, the legendary editor of the Vorwärts, the sort of most celebrated American Yiddish newspaper, you know, a story about Jewish immigrants on the Lower East Side and sort of what life was like for them. We have a speech by Emma Goldman, the great anarchist orator and activist who often spoke in Yiddish to Jewish audiences. And it's a speech she gave, you know, a blistering, amazing speech against marriage as a concept, saying, you know, talking about how oppressive marriage is as a tool of capitalism. We have so that's that first section. Then we have a section about language and linguistics called the Mother Tongue Remixed, which just talks about the history of the language and dictionaries and offers some of the sort of famous pithy expressions in Yiddish. We have a section about food because for better and for worse, when people think about Yiddish and when they think about Ashkenazi Jewish culture in America, they think about things like bagels and lox. And so we have some stories about that and some histories and some explanations of the etymology of some of those food words.
There's even some recipes.
And even a few recipes that are, you know, kind of fun to see. There's an old, not just, you know, Jewish communities or individual Jewish authors put out cookbooks in Yiddish, but American companies like Crisco would put out Yiddish language cookbooks to reach Jewish audiences. So it's fun to represent some of that. And then we have two more literary sections, one of sort of Yiddish writers in translation and some of the best known Yiddish writers, as well as some writers that maybe people wouldn't be as familiar with. And then we have a long section about the children, about the generation of Americans whose parents or grandparents were Yiddish speakers and who were inspired in some way by the Yiddish that they heard or the Yiddish culture that they were connected to do things in American literature or poetry or graphic novels or Hollywood or, you know, all sorts of different aspects of American culture. And then finally, the last section is came about when we realized at some point in working on this, as Ilan and I looked at each other, as we already had the title for the book, that here was a book that had America in the title, not once, but twice. And it was being edited by a Canadian and a Mexican, so we felt like we had to we had to get some of Latin America in the mix and some of Canada in the mix, and you know, in part because, you know, and I think Ilan's family, my family, is a testament to that, that where people ended up, whether they ended up in New York or in Montreal or in Mexico City, really was a roll of the dice, and you know, was often a very left up to chance. And so there's a lot of connections between, and also a lot of differences between the way Yiddish culture developed in the US and in other countries in the Americas.
Yeah. And where did the authors that you included, where did they come from and where did they live?
Do you mean the ones outside of America or all of them?
All of them. I mean, you know, did they tend to cluster in particular places? Were they, you know, more geographically, you know, dispersed?
We tried to find some examples, you know, that were, that would show some of the geographic sort of spread of Yiddish in America. Although obviously New York was a huge center of Yiddish culture. So, you know, if you made a map of the contributors, many of them would be clustered in the tri-state area. And, you know, but we did look for to include some pieces that would, you know, reflect other, you know, other examples. I'm trying to think of a good example. I believe if I'm remembering, I think one of the poems we chose is a Chaim Grada poem about the West, about the American West, you know, just to sort of have examples of like, all American Jews, Yiddish speakers ended up in, you know, every sort of corner of the country. And so, you know, most of the writers who are represented were themselves immigrants, were born in Europe and ended up immigrating either as children or as young adults and ended up writing in America. And then, of course, many of the people who are the children of Yiddish speakers were American-born who have their parents' culture in one way or another.
Yeah, I actually came across some of Chaim Grada's writing in Yiddish about the West. So Chaim Grada didn't live in the West. He lived in New York. But I remember a bunch of years ago reading, maybe it was a poem or something, or some description of the West. And it's a very, you know, American, it's very echtike, true American, you know, Americana, you know, but in Yiddish. And I thought it was like the strangest thing I've ever seen, because, you know, and maybe this is part of what your book is trying to get at, that, you know, our conception of what Yiddish is limited, you know, that when we think of, when most people think of Yiddish, they either think of Eastern Europe or the people who, you know, immigrated from Eastern Europe and then they came to America, but specifically, you know, the Lower East Side or the Bronx or something like that. And here was Chaim Grada, who I do believe lived in the Bronx, but, you know, was writing about the American West and the Indians. And he was very interested in trying to portray, you know, a completely different side of the American experience through Yiddish, you know, the Yiddish tongue.
Well, you know, part of it is explained in the simplest way possible. There were pages to fill in the Yiddish newspapers, and you'd had to fill them with something interesting, and you couldn't write about East Broadway every day. So they would send, you know, people would go. I mean, by the way, there was still, in the first half of the 20th century, there was still a huge audience in Europe that was fascinated to hear about the American West or what life was like in America. You know, at its height, the Forward had local editions in, I think, more than half a dozen cities in America. So that gives you a sense of, you know, Yiddish being spread out throughout the country. But yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you know, I don't think we have it in the anthology. Isaac Raboy wrote novels about his time as a cowboy, you know, rustling cattle, because he came, I think, from Bessarabia, and he knew how to work with horses. So he went out to, I think, North Dakota and, you know, worked on farms and wrote about it in Yiddish. Again, not that that was the typical experience for everyone, but, you know, as writers looked for fascinating, exotic, interesting things to write about. And so they tried to do that, as well as, you know, in search of places to live and jobs and opportunities, Jews scattered to all corners of the country. So you can often find fascinating little bits of Yiddish culture in all sorts of different places, unexpected places in America.
Yeah, and speaking of Yiddish writing that surprises the reader, were there ways that Yiddish or some of Yiddish literature scandalized its readers? You know, not just surprised them, but really shocked them in some profound way.
Yeah, so that aspect of Yiddish is to some degree represented in the anthology by a chapter from a very famous play by the Yiddish playwright and novelist Sholem Ash, God von Nekoma, God of Vengeance, which was performed in Europe first, but then was performed in America. And famously, when it was performed in English translation on Broadway, it led to the director and the whole cast being arrested for indecency. It's a play about a brothel, and there's a lesbian relationship represented quite explicitly in it, and it was a lot to experience. Now, this is something that I've written about. What's fascinating is that at a time when there were quite strict standards for what you could publish in English in America, and there was quite a good amount of enforcement of that publishers were actually had reason to be afraid that if they published something that was too sexually explicit, they could get arrested. They could get raided. Their stocks, their you know, all the books they had in their warehouse could get burned. Yiddish publishers and writers mostly evaded that kind of attention from the American sort of police and post office, not because what they were publishing wasn't sometimes scandalous, but because it was harder to get the post office or the police to care about a Yiddish newspaper or a Yiddish magazine. So there were tons of debates in American Yiddish culture about what was fit to print and what wasn't. There were debates about what proper poetry looked like. There were debates about, you know, when Sholomash, when that play was first performed, long before it was in English on Broadway, when it was in Yiddish, people called the police. People thought it was horrible. They were deeply disturbed by it, because you know, writers in almost every language want to push buttons and want to find ways to go further than other writers have, or find ways to explore difficult or challenging material. So you do have that. I mean, and in this, you know, in the collection, you know, another example of that, which comes from a later period, from the post-war period, is Bluma Lempel's very disturbing, very difficult story, Oedipus in Brooklyn, which is really Bluma Lempel writing after the war, at a time of, you know, just real deep pain for Yiddish speakers and Yiddish writers, you know, experiencing, thinking about the horrors of the 20th century. And it's a story that I think unflinchingly tries to imagine just some of the most painful possible things. And I think that's something that writers, you know, great writers in all languages like to do. And certainly it was a part of what Yiddish literary culture tried to take on.
Yeah, I interestingly, the Sholomash play that you were talking about, the God from the Kama, the God of Vengeance, that was so scandalous in the 1930s 20s. Or 20s, was recently put on off Broadway. I was went on stage again and was a tremendous sensation in Yiddish, you know, with English and I think maybe Russian subtitles. So it seems to be coming around in some sense.
Well, that, I mean, I love, that's a play that I love to teach. It's it is really strange. it's a great, you know, Ash is a, but you know, there's people can argue about it, but I think there's no question Ash is just an unbelievably major 20th century writer whose works were, his novels in the 40s were immediately, you know, they were released in Yiddish and English at the same time. They were translated immediately and they sold hundreds of thousands of copies in English. They were famous. I mean, he was profiled in the New York Times. He was, you know, as famous as a writer could be. So it's a little sad that I think some sort of more casual readers don't know Ash's work, but it's really powerful.
Yeah, but he in particular seems to have had an interest in being provocative. I don't know if it, for its own sake or for some higher cultural or moral you know, goal, but he does seem to have set himself up to provoke. In addition to his play, The God of Vengeance, he also has a trilogy all about Jesus and the Holy Family. One of them is called The Nazarene, and the other one is called Mary, and the other one's called, I think, Paul. And those also were considered extremely scandalous within the Jewish sort of Yiddish cultural scene, because it was felt that those were somehow had a kind of missionary purpose or something, to get people to be Christian or something like that.
Yeah. No, look, it's true. He was definitely, you can think of him as a writer who was out there to provoke, but it's actually on the contrary, I'd say it's actually hard to think of a really important, interesting, major modernist writer who wasn't, in Yiddish or in another language. In Yiddish, you have people like Isaac Bashevis Singer, who was very provocative, who wrote stories about what we would call the trans experience, about all sorts of sexual improprieties, You know, his first novel ends in what I think you can only describe as an orgy, a sinful, blasphemous orgy. So, you know, and many of Yiddish poets dealt with, you know, very intimate, intense emotions. But then again, you know, James Joyce, Henry Miller, you know, Philip Roth, you know, pick a writer from the 20th century who wrote in English, or in, certainly if we name French writers, German writers, it would be easy to think of writers who dealt with material just as transgressive and troubling.
Sure, sure. Well, would you say that there's an overall message of your anthology?
I'm not sure a message per se, but I think what we tried to capture, you know, there have been other anthologies of Yiddish literature and translation, many of which are excellent. What we tried to capture was the sort of energy of and the enthusiasm of the Yiddish Book Center, which is a place that, you know, takes Yiddish very seriously and tries to engage with the most serious scholarship and the most and not to ignore in any way, tries not to ignore the painful parts of the history of Yiddish speaking people, which are obviously very important, but to take joy in the language and its possibilities, and to be sort of open to the surprises you can find in it. That's, I think, what the anthology is trying to do. And that's why, you know, it's a smorgasbord. It's filled with all sorts of surprises. We wanted to make sure that you would flip through it and not, you know, it's not designed to read through in one go, but to flip through and find discoveries and have that sense of surprise and excitement. And that's, I think, what the anthology is trying to capture.
Well, it's certainly extremely captivating. Well, before we let you go, I'd like to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about a current project or a new project that you're working on.
Sure. Well, it's very different, right? This anthology is a little bit more fun. In my more serious scholarly hat, my next book, which is on its way, is about American Jews and the publishing industry. It sort of asks the question of how it mattered to the history of American literature and to American culture that even at times where there was quite a bit of anti-Semitic prejudice in American culture, American Jews were very empowered within the publishing industry and ran publishing companies and were, you know, major editors, and how it changed what was published about Jews, about non-Jews, about other subjects. So that book, which is going to be called The Literary Mafia, is almost done and should come out within a couple of years.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. Josh, thanks so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much for doing this. It's really a pleasure to talk about the book.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.